step forward.
What was something that was a real joy for you in putting this book together? I'm sure as an academic, you've probably written lots of books. What was a highlight for you that you really just enjoyed in doing this particular book?
Thank you for the question. I haven't really had a chance to reflect on it, but I think there are a couple things. One is, I approached the work very humbly, and it was just a beautiful thing for me to see the diversity of queer Black life in America, thriving on both kinds of campuses. That's a very hopeful thing for me to be able to, reflect upon the fact that there is no one way to be Black, there is no one way to be queer, there is no one way to be Black and queer in America. And the students, by virtue of their stories, the students kind of made that truth very plain for me and for the reader, for all the readers in the book. That's a really powerful thing. The other thing is, when students came to talk about the moments of joy that they had experienced, making friends, going to the movies, going to museums, going to a gay club for the first time in their lives, to see their faces light up, like it calls to mind, some of those formative experience that any of us would have had, regardless of your identity as a young person, like the flowering of friendship and the importance of making those social connections and how good and warm that feeling is. Those were the moments when I felt a great deal of joy in talking to the students. It was like the way they spoke about friendship gave me a lot of joy as a listener and as a writer. Thank you for the question. Like I said, I really haven't thought about it that much.
What is your target audience? Do you have a demographic you're really going for with your book?
I mean, everyone. I hope everyone reads it. I mean, I will say that the students in the book were really grateful. I had a number of students tell me, like, thank you so much for taking the time. Like, nobody's ever asked me these questions before. So at the very least, I'm hoping that queer Black college students will pick up the book and reflect on how their experiences either match up with or challenge the experiences that they read about in the book. So that's a primary audience for sure. But honestly, I think college students, in women's and gender studies and sexuality studies classes, sociology classes, students who are studying higher ed, I mean, all the audiences involved in those areas, I'm hopeful that they'll find something out of the book that's valuable. And then, this is a book that's really about the stories of the students. I try not to kind of weigh it down with a bunch of academic language and kind of let the students speak for themselves. And that kind of storytelling, I hope, appeals to readers from all different backgrounds, right? I think we all would do well to open ourselves up to kind of get into the lives of people who might not share the same experiences that we did. So even if you don't identify as part of this community, I'm sure there's something valuable for you to gain.
What did you have to do to prepare yourself for doing a book of this, of this narrative? Did you have to, immerse yourself in a field of, queer studies? Were you already pretty familiar with most of the subject matter that you were interviewing the students about? What did you do to prepare for this?
Yeah, I teach some of this stuff as, as even before I started the book, I work on area of race and gender. So I was familiar with some of the reading, the background reading that I did, but I did, do a whole lot more reading and try to just familiarize myself with the state of the field. But to be clear, like, this is a privilege for me. This is a joy. You know what I mean? Like, this is a labor of love that there's nothing almost nothing I'd rather be doing than like reading a really interesting book about race or gender or things along those lines. So yeah, the preparation was part of it, but that's fun for me. And the same thing when I approached the interviews. I mean, I think one of the things that served me really well was in all of the books I've written, what I do is I go out and interview people and then I kind of try to put together what they told me. So I think if you want to think about it in that way, the other preparation I had was all the interviews about other topics that I'd done before this. It's just every interview you do, I feel like makes you a little bit of a better interviewer. So I'm grateful that like this wasn't my first rodeo in terms of interviewing people. I just get a lot out of these conversations, and it's a huge privilege. People are generous with their time, and they're open with their thoughts. And this is fun for me. You know, it's I don't view it as, oh no, I have to prepare to do this work. I view it as like, I can't believe I get, this is my job and I get to do it for a living.
What surprised you the most, you know, of all the interviews that you did as you were writing your book? Was there anything that surprised you, something that was unexpected that you didn't anticipate when you were thinking about writing this book?
So I think one thing that surprised me was the different kinds of answers when students were talking about politics and about Black Lives Matter. So I think I went into some of these conversations thinking to myself, well, the students are going to talk about how radical they are and how engaged they are in politics and what an important moment this is for all of us to stand up for what we believe in and how closely they identify with Black Lives Matter and all of these kinds of things. And there really were a range of responses. So for example, some students told me that like Black Lives Matter was a great movement for addressing police violence, but that was really the only thing that it addressed. And it was too focused on the experiences of Black men, especially cis Black men. So they didn't really see it as an issue that spoke to some of the most important things that they were dealing with, right? Some students told me that although they really weren't comfortable with the politics of the country at the moment, like they didn't really think of themselves as political people. And I was kind of going into it thinking, well, of course they're political, you know, they're political just by virtue of who they are. But students, you know, students, like, I don't feel political most of the time. Like, I'm just trying to do my thing here. And I don't want to be worried about, like, the crazy thing that somebody said on the news today or yesterday. I can't live my life in that kind of reactive way to every moment. So those were, I think, some of the surprises for me were, you know, those moments when students told me, like, you know, politics really isn't my thing, you know, or Black Lives Matter is cool, but I don't really identify that closely with it. Those things were surprising to me.
What about a common threads throughout the stories of all the students that you talked to? Were there common threads that everyone or a majority of the Black queer students shared with you?
I think one of the it's hard because, you know, speak to 65 people and nothing's going to be exactly the same across 65 interviews. But, you know, I think that one of the things that became a common thread was, you know, that the negotiation of gender and sexuality was something that students were negotiating alongside or synchronous with their racial identity. All these things were tied together. Race and gender and sexuality were tied together. So when they were thinking about their identities, they were really kind of thinking about them kind of all at once and how they kind of informed each other. And that's something that has been discussed by other people who have studied or spoken with the folks who belong to these communities is, you know, there's a kind of negotiation of Blackness that comes along with the negotiation of LGBTQ plus identity for many of the people who are living it.
One of the things that I've noticed in my 10 years of radio production is that the issues that are specific to non-binary people has become more and more prevalent within both the academic world and also within the world of queer spaces. Did the students that you talked to, did many of them identify as non-binary? How did those conversations go?
Yeah, this is an interesting issue. I think that, yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I can tell you absolutely, there were plenty of students I spoke with who either identified as non-binary or gender fluid, which I know to some people doesn't mean exactly the same thing, but I feel like we're kind of that's the kind of space in which we're talking about right now. And it's interesting because, you know, I think that sometimes, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, honestly, you know, like sometimes I think people say the word non-binary and they almost kind of mean it as a third category, right? Like male, female, non-binary, right? They almost kind of mean it as a third category, not unlike the other categories. But sometimes people say non-binary or gender fluid and they mean it as, I don't believe in the categories at all. Do you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, I could sense that a bit during my conversations that for some people it kind of meant one thing and for some people it kind of meant something different. But I think that when you mention why these conversations are becoming more central. I think that's one of the reasons they're becoming more central, is because there's a conversation within the LGBTQ plus community around what those words mean and what they signify. So I don't mean to like throw it back to you, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it too, because I think that one of the reasons it's becoming more central is there is a contest and there is a discussion around what are we saying, right? What are we intending to communicate when we use the word non-binary? Do you know what I mean?
I think part of it is just deconstructing gender.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a lot of it. I think that a lot of people are realizing that they don't have to live by the gender that they were raised with and with the expectations of that gender. So it gets to a question of biological essentialism. It gets to a question of, is gender innate? Or is it, you know, is it something that is learned? Is it acquired? And I think that a lot of people are saying, I don't believe that it's innate. I believe that to a large degree it's acquired, and that I can choose to have a gender identity if I want to, or I can choose to drop the trappings of gender and the expectations of gender, especially the expectations that oppress me or oppress people who see me within a particular category, you know, that suppress my expectations for the future, the role that I'll play in society, the amount of space that I can take up in relationship to people around me. I think all of those issues are issues that people who are identifying as non-binary are making a conscious choice to, you know, to say, I don't accept this. I don't accept this categorization.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and off the top of my head, that's really powerful. And I don't think I had an interview in the book where a student said like exactly what you just said, but there were certainly moments during some of our conversations where, you know, that sort of explanation that you just gave came through really strongly, right? And I kind of referred to it early in the interview, where it's like these categories that have, you know, been sort of institutionalized for so long, like there's this belief that like they don't apply, they're not real in any lasting sense of the word, and we have to be able to imagine something different from them. So I think that was definitely present in some of the conversations that I had. And then I think there were some students who, you know, really didn't really understood the moment they were living in as kind of a fluid moment, right? And the term non-binary was close enough to that fluidity and that uncertainty that they felt, that was the word they felt most comfortable using at the time. And they might not be committed to it like for the rest of their lives, but at the time, that was better than the alternatives, right? The categories that we've had for so long. So I think all those things were swirling around our conversations.
Professor Jeffries, what are your hopes for the future for students who are queer and Black on campus? If you could think about the students that you interviewed and the topics that you covered, what are some of your hopes for change for students in the future?
I would like to see leadership at colleges and universities, no matter whether they're predominantly white institutions or HBCUs, sort of take more responsibility for some of the basics around these things, for educating students, staff, and faculty around terminology, history, the challenges that these groups face on campus. That's a very basic thing. The students told me that often they felt like it was their responsibility to educate their campus and their community. And I just think that's an abandonment of responsibility by the leadership of these institutions. So that's one thing. Secondly, you know, I want to see these students. I want to see them happy. it sounds simplistic, but honestly, I think that's a baseline. That's like a bare minimum for what we should expect to come out of this work, right? And I want them to feel valued. I want them to feel like they can be leaders. I want them to feel like they'll have a community on their campus that will last beyond the years that they're there. I think that one of the powerful things that I realized in talking with them was the students who were able to build friendships and build these social networks on campus, it actually helped them feel stronger connections to the university or to the college as a whole, right? So it's good for, you know, it's good for the colleges, right, to have students building these friendship networks and relating to each other and forming the bonds that will kind of sustain them beyond their time on campus. So those are maybe just a couple of things. And then, you know, more broadly and ambitiously, like, you know, we have to be unafraid to confront and stand up to the homophobia, the transphobia, the racism and the sexism that we're dealing with in our current political moment. And we can't place all of that burden on the folks who are the most vulnerable to those forces. Those of us who have privileges, whether it's gender privileges, socioeconomic privileges, racial privileges, it's our responsibility to step up and be the advocates and be the voices rather than, you know, letting it always fall to the most vulnerable members of our communities.
We've been talking tonight with Professor Michael P. Jeffries, the Dean of Academic Affairs at Wellesley College, about your new book, Black and Queer on Campus. Professor Jeffries, if people would like to find out more about your book, if they'd like to, you know, purchase the book or find out more about the topic, where can they find out more about your book?
Well, the book is available at, you know, some of our most common booksellers like Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You can get it there. It's also available directly from NYU Press. That's the publisher. You can also go to my website, Michael P. Jeffries, all one word. Jeffries is J-E-F-F-R-I-E-S, MichaelPJeffries.com, to learn more about the book and the rest of my work.
Professor Jeffries, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Transpositive.
Truly my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing forward discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
During the last 6 weeks, you heard the special programming of our winter fundraising drive. Thank you for supporting Volume 2 of the All Thrills, No Frills campaign. KBOO is on course to exceed our goal of $17,000 as the final checks come through the mail. If you haven't already, get your limited edition Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Please go to kboo.fm/bgshirt. This design was created by a volunteer creator from Music from the True Vine, which airs every Saturday at 9 a.m. Don't wait.